Our final speaker this morning is a research scholar and lecturer at Princeton University, an author and editor, and a self-described lawyer turned ecologist. While he is best known for his papers on biofuels and land use, his work today is well aligned to ours, combining ecology and economics to analyse the challenge of how to feed the world while reducing agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Tim Sertina.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Minister, for having me. I am delighted to be here, and not only because I've always wanted to come to New Zealand, and this is my first time, but because I think what you're doing here today is extremely important. And if the primary job, the primary criterion for choosing me to speak was my admiration for this effort, then I was well selected. And so what I'm going to try to do today is remind you of many things you already know on the importance of your work and offer a few thoughts, maybe constructive thoughts, on how you can go about that effort. We had a conference in Princeton just about a year ago called Feeding a Hot and Hungry Planet, and that really is our challenge. These are the figures from the 2007 IPCC report. The numbers have changed a little bit since then, but what we see is that agricultural emissions, if we include land use change, and the land use change deforestation emissions that get counted are overwhelmingly the emissions that come from the conversion of forests in the tropics to agricultural lands. Whether or not they are attributable entirely to agriculture is one unanswerable question at some level, but what we also know is that unless we find a way to feed ourselves without expanding that agricultural land, we will cause those emissions. And together, land use change and the direct reduction emissions cause something on the order of 30% of world greenhouse gas emissions. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge is that they're going to grow. By 2050, we don't really have estimates, but if we assume that we're going to roughly double the emissions, and we have estimates about 70% increases in food production, but probably even larger increases in livestock. If we double emissions, just on the production side alone, we're talking about something on the order of 14 or 15 gigatons of CO2 per year. Now, the world adopted a 2-degree target, Celsius target for climate change mitigation. And at least in the EU, that has been defined as essentially reducing emissions per year generated by 2050 to around 15 gigatons. There are some other estimates that maybe go up to 2025, but what you can see is that unless we reduce our agricultural emissions, production emissions, they will use up most or even all of the room we have for emissions by 2050. So that is a big challenge. Now, the other reason it's a big challenge is it's only half of the challenge. We have tremendous hunger still in the world today. And you know the figures, roughly a billion people. And one reason it's only a billion people is that we have had steady increases in agricultural productivity for decades. And those increases in productivity have brought down the price of basic crops. And while that has almost no effect on the price of food that I pay in the supermarket, because crops are such a small portion of the final retail food price, it has a great significance for the price that the poor pay for food, because they're buying not corn flakes, but corn meal. So declining prices are important. And because of declining prices, even as the population grew to now 6.7 billion people, the number of hungry people in the world basically stayed constant. And it started growing when crop prices started rising again in recent years. Of course, culminating in the tremendous price increases we had in 2008, which reminded the world that food cannot be taken for granted. And so we are here now with this dual challenge. And some parts of agriculture in the past have been defensive at being linked with other sectors of the economy that generate emissions have environmental impacts. But the lesson, of course, here is not that we need less agriculture. We need even better and better and more efficient agriculture, just as we need everything else. But for the efficiency gains, the productivity increases by agriculture in the last several decades, our hunger situation would be worse, our emissions profiles would be worse. But we now have this challenge, which the Prime Minister spoke about, of somehow we have to produce roughly on the order of 70% more food, while probably cutting the greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture in half. That is equivalent to the challenge in the energy sector. And the difference is that everybody knows that that is a huge technological challenge in the energy sector. But very few people think about it as an equivalent challenge in the agricultural sector. We have a lead journalist at Princeton who writes on climate change for the New York Times, and a colleague of mine deliberately asked him a question that was about the impact of agriculture on greenhouse gas emissions, and he answered it by talking about the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on agriculture, because that has been the focus up to now. And I think what New Zealand has hopefully done by forging this alliance and bringing you all together is to remind you and help get the world to understand that our agricultural technological challenge is very much like our energy technological challenge. Now, let me explore that a bit more deeply. So this is probably a chart many of you have seen from the IPCC, and it identifies mitigation potential up to $100 a ton of CO2. And I'm sorry, some of the figures, the legends at the bottom are hard to read, but the critical factor is that the red is all CO2. And it represents almost entirely carbon sequestration. And 90% of the mitigation potential that was identified by the IPCC was all in the form of carbon sequestration on the land. Now that's a great thing to have. But first couple thoughts. In most of the world, not the whole world, that's not going to be used, even if we can pull it off, to mitigate agricultural emissions. It's going to be sold to the energy sector as an offset, to offset energy emissions. So even if that turns out to be wildly successful, it will not reduce our challenge at all. It just will make it easier for the energy sector. The second thing is that, as we're warned by the IPCC, is that that will saturate, even if successful. And the third is that the remaining mitigation was only 10% that they could identify at that time. That's a very modest amount of emissions. That's basically 10% of the nitrous oxide methane emissions today. That's assuming you can pull it all off. And the IPCC warned that we therefore needed major new innovation. And this is the first meeting I know of to really focus on achieving that recommendation. Let me talk a little bit more, though, about carbon sequestration. There have been lots of reasons why the world has focused on carbon sequestration. There are three or four atoms of carbon in vegetation and soil for every atom of carbon in the atmosphere. So keeping carbon on the ground, in the ground, is very important. And the scientific community has tried to be optimistic about the potential. I got to tell you, I don't think we have that basis for optimism today. It's going to be really hard. So the first thing is most of those estimates, or much of those estimates, was based on simply switching to no-till farming. And unfortunately today, we now know that our measurements of carbon sequestration from no-till farming were based on looking only at the top 10 centimeters. And as other scientists have looked at deeper soil depths, it is unclear whether or not no-till farming is actually going to increase carbon sequestration. We simply don't know what's coming. Second point is that most of the analyses have indicated that no-till farming increases nitrous oxide emissions, at least in the first 5 or 10 years. And most no-till farming only goes on for 5 or 10 years before you plow off. So at this point, while there are a lot of benefits to no-till farming for other environmental values, We don't even know if that's going to help us in the carbon sequestration. A second thing is we had a presentation at Princeton from Cheryl Palm, who is the New York Science Institute of Columbia, and perhaps the most knowledgeable person on the soils of Africa. And she described to us the challenges of trying to sequester carbon in the soils of Africa. And we can do it technically. It's just maintaining the economics and the drive for that. There are projects where people have worked extremely well with local farmers to do the time-consuming activities to add mulch, to use perennial crops to try to get carbon back into the soil. And you come back a few years later and only a little of that is being practiced. Because in the real world, actually, in Africa, labor is a highly limiting factor in agricultural production, even though we don't tend to think about it. You have bad years when you have to focus just on getting enough food for your family, and the long-term productivity gains are hard to think about. It's tough. Even more pessimistically, and I'll still have some optimism in this report, there's a reasonable chance we're actually losing soil carbon today. There have been some measurements in New Zealand, I'm going to hope to learn more about them, that suggest that even New Zealand, which has the best pasture management in the world, may actually be losing a lot of soil carbon underneath those pastures. And there are new studies in the U.S. that indicate, and these are interesting studies, they are studies that try to analyze where the nitrogen is coming for crops in the Midwest. It's actually hard to find the sources for old nitrogen that are taken up by the crops that are lost to the region. And when they close the books, they have to assume that there is nitrogen coming out of the soils to feed our crops. Now, the way nitrogen comes out of soils is that the soils break down and you lose the carbon. So this is a reminder as well that there is a tremendous amount we don't know. In the U.S., we report either no soil carbon loss or even small carbon soil carbon gains. Those are based on certain models, but there is much we don't know. So I think soil carbon sequestration is important, it's critical for productivity enhancement, it's something we need to focus on, but we can't put all of our energy into that. So now we have big new ideas. And one of the things I want to, the lessons I would provide is that while I was brought up in an era when the environmentally correct thing was to say, let's think small, my lesson here is, let's think large. In other words, we need to focus on the small management changes that can help, and we also need to focus on the big ideas. And one of the big ideas that I'm sure you all know about is biochar. And I'm not going to give too much presentation on that, and I don't know if it's really going to work out. But the basic theory behind biochar is that, particularly if we focus on crop residues, we can transform them into a form that will stay longer in the soil. And so this is one of the big new ideas. As you probably know, biochar was discovered, as it were, by learning that in the farms, the ancient farms in the Amazon, Brazil, the Native Americans had put charcoal back into the soil, and you can still find that today. And so that's one of the big ideas worthy of the research is beginning to get, frankly, used more. So we need to focus on big ideas, but also need to focus on management ideas. Now, I'm going to mention a little bit about biofuels. Because biofuels are also sometimes put into the category of agricultural sequestration or agricultural mitigation. Again, it's a little bit of an odd place to put them, because they won't mitigate agricultural emissions, they would, if anything, mitigate energy emissions. The basic theory behind biofuels, the reason people think biofuels have the potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, is of course because of the word bio. Bio means they start from plants. Growing plants, of course, takes carbon out of the atmosphere. So in theory, when you burn the biofuel, you just put the carbon back into the atmosphere. Unlike fossil fuels, we take carbon out of the ground and you put it in the atmosphere. Now, I've been involved in writing a number of papers that others have now built on. And basically, there's one problem with that, which is plants are growing in. If you use land to produce plants for biofuels, you're not using land to produce plants for other purposes. So what we need are additional plants. It's only the additional plants that count. And most of our analyses have counted all the plants, as though there were no plants there otherwise, either sequestered carbon or producing heat. Now, pretty much every really large estimate of bioenergy potential that you have probably seen directly or indirectly counts carbon in the organism. So the IPCC itself has had a couple places published analyses of enormous potential. Basically, things could produce all of our energy through bioenergy by assuming that we could use all the potential cropland that we're not already using. Now, what is the world's potential cropland that we're not already using? It's essentially the world's forests and weather systems that are stored carbon. And most of that land that's available is in Latin America and Africa. That's precisely the carbon we need to keep in source. There have been other forms of these estimates. One of them is all forest growth that we're not already harvesting. Now, as many of you probably know, we have regrown forests in the Northern Hemisphere because we cut them down decades ago. And those regrown forests are contributing roughly 9.5 gigatons of terrestrial carbon sink. But for the terrestrial carbon sink, basically about 20% of all the CO2 that's being emitted would not be being absorbed and would be being much worse off. Now, if we burn up the terrestrial carbon sink, we're not be better off. So I won't go through all of these lists. But the key point is that you can only count land, you can only count plants. Now, it's not just biology that's made this error. Also, there are lots of estimates of enormous potential for afforestation to sequester carbon. And in pretty much every one of those cases, the afforestation ignores what's already going on in the land. And when you look at all of the uses of land that people talk about, most of the analyses assume, at least the IPCC analyses assume, to be a lot of cropland. We have land with regrowing forests that we're already using. We're trying to avoid deforestation. We want to increase forests. And then one of the potential benefits is to take up our peat lands that have been drained and reconvert them back under the drainage. You realize we're counting a lot of the same land over and over again. And in fact, it turns out that the IPCC, in their baseline scenarios, this was the scenario they used to analyze what would happen if we didn't address climate change. They mostly assumed that we would have solved land deforestation by 2050. Because by 2050, the population would have stabilized. So in other words, if we stop deforestation, to a large extent, we're just getting back the situation that the IPCC recognized as the baseline we were trying to avoid. That doesn't mean we don't have to stop deforestation. It means it's really, really, really important that we stop deforestation. Okay, so what are the lessons from that? Key lessons are land really matters. That's the key lesson. We need to make more productive use of the land we've got to get our forests. Now, let me go into the question of what is our capacity to do that? Well, depending on who you read and what you focus on, you can make yourself either very depressed or optimistic. And I'm not quite sure. So on the depressing side, the blue line is declining yield for zero growth. And you can see it's declining steadily. And USDA predicts world zero growth the next decade and 0.8% per year. Meanwhile, the population is also declining, but not as much. Why is yield growth in decline? There's a basic reason. Our yield growth is linear, not exponential. So we basically get more food every year, more cereals every year per hectare, roughly the same amount as the previous year. But on a percentage basis, that's a smaller amount. Now, corn is the success story right now. Rice and wheat are less so. But the bottom line is, we're going to have to expect declining yield growth on a percentage basis. There are other problems. I was recently at a conference where John Riley at MIT presented the results of their model. They were one of the world's most sophisticated models. And I was surprised to see that they did not have significant decreases in deforestation by 2050. And the reason for that was because of the impact of ozone increases. Ozone has huge impacts on many crops, and most models don't bother to incorporate that into the analysis. And rising temperatures will increase ozone concentrations in the present. Well, there's climate change itself. The more recent studies that are a little bit more sophisticated than the last ones that generally focus on maximum temperatures and changes in numbers of days of high temperature are predicting that climate change will have generally negative effects on agricultural production. The earlier models were predicting rough balance at least up to a degree and a half or so between northern hemisphere gains and southern hemisphere losses. Now it looks like the more likely case is negative. And then of course we have the problem with water. We're basically, there's not a lot of irrigation water left. The general estimate is that irrigation agriculture produces about 40% of our food. There's not a lot more water to go around. Okay, that's the best. Here's the optimism. We have big yield gaps. We know in Malawi alone, just by adding some more fertilizer, essentially we're able to double their yields. So Africa is a huge opportunity. And yield gap analysis has inherent limitations and flaws, but we know we can do a lot better. And by some analyses, we can produce maybe 70-80% of the additional food we're going to need just by closing these yield gaps. Another thing we know is there's a tremendous amount of food waste. We don't really know how to stop that. But we know that somehow or other there's a lot of food out there that we could use better. Biotechnology, different estimates even by experts on how much additional gains we're likely to get from biotechnology, but clearly some. And then a lot of people ignore the potential for livestock intensification, and that's probably as big, if not bigger, than the potential for crop yield. So when the FAO looked at this most recently, they actually predicted that we only needed 120 million hectares of additional cropland by 2050, which would be less deforestation than we otherwise are talking about by a lot, just for cropland. So I think the potential is there. But the message is we've got to be prudent. And one of the things is all of these analyses are not counting fire. Now, MIT as well did a model analysis of what it would take for the world to produce 15%, roughly speaking, of the world's energy in 2050 by bioenergy. A paper was published in Science. And if land use change simply reflected economic forces, that's what would happen to our energy force. Okay. Key lesson for this is agricultural productivity matters a lot. And the good news as well is many of the things that we're going to do or we need to do to boost agricultural productivity will also reduce the emissions per unit of food from the production side. So there is upside potential. We need to focus on getting more out of the land we've got, not just shifting the uses of carbon from one to another, from food to fuel. It doesn't help solve our problem. Take productive land that's producing food that people need and shifting it to fuel because we have to reproduce the food. The other thing, and this is, I think, gets to one of the important research issues, is all our analyses of what's going to reduce emissions have to the impact on the land. So some of the things we're going to do are going to increase the production emissions. If you add fertilizer in Africa, it will increase the production emissions, but it will save land. We have to be able to have a simple mechanism for evaluating when that is good and when it's not good. But it's not always good. If you increase Corn production in Iowa by adding more fertilizer today, you'll probably get more emissions than if you increase land use. So that's one of the same challenges we need to solve. Okay. We go on to a second issue. Now, in the U.S., those people here from the U.S. who know the solution, we have a comment named Rodney Danger. And Rodney Danger feels shit because he didn't get any respect. So a typical Rodney Danger joke would be, I felt getting respect when I was born. The doctors looked at my dad. They said we did everything we could, but he was born anyway. And in the world of academics studying food production, the Rodney Dangerfield of land use is raising money. Now, the reason of land is more than twice as much as the world's property. And it gets, we know less about it, it gets less studied. One of the things, however, became clear to me is that grazing land is a huge source of emissions and needs to be a big part of our business. Now, the first thing, this slide is actually designed to say, well, how, by the way, did the IPCC estimates assume that we could have 200 to 500 million more hectares of land across it and reduce deforestation by 2050? And many of them were because they assumed that we would get all of that additional cropland from a land use category called other. FAO has a land use category called other. Nobody really knows what other is. Other is basically wetter savannas and woodlots. And when you look at some of the studies that aren't clearly counting carbon, we already got for bioenergy or reforestation or food production, it's supposed to come out of policy. Now, here's the good news. The good news is there is underutilized land in the world. The bad news is we don't really know where it is. And if it's not utilized, there's probably a reason. So one of the things that I think we really need to do is identify what are these underutilized lands. And we have to ask questions. Are they maybe unutilized? Do they store a lot of carbon? Are they sequestering carbon? Are they in fact producing food that we're not counting? Are they areas of great biodiversity? The world's savannas as a whole are centers of biodiversity. Then we have to ask, okay, if they're not being used, what are the barriers? If there are ownership problems, are there tsetse flies? What do we do to utilize those lands? So one of the basic research projects for land that I think we need to explore is really looking at what are we going to do. Again, on the carbon sequestration front, I think I've jumped off and come back to rangeland. But on the carbon sequestration front, another thing we know is that these peatlands, particularly in Southeast Asia, are generating an enormous amount of carbon sequestration. These are the peatlands that are being converted to palm oil plantations, and they're probably generating roughly the order of 2% of the world's CO2 emissions, these peatlands alone. Now, they're producing a valuable product. The question is, are there peatlands that we could find a way to restore or undrain, and certainly if there's trying to limit that. Another opportunity we have, again, this is in the carbon front, is we do know that there are crop residues that are being burned. There was one recent study, I think a really good study, in the Punjab province that indicated that 70% of the rice straw was being burned, which causes its own problems. That is obviously a product that could be used for bioenergy and also reduce methane emissions from bioenergy. So, okay, now this is where I really want to get back to the range on something. The other reason I'm actually reasonably confident that we can stop deforestation while feeding the world is that at least if we trust FAO data, 2/3 of the deforestation is being triggered by expansion of rangeland, not cropland, on a net basis. And here, the pink areas are the pasture expansion, and the blue areas are the cropland expansion. And this was a paper by some people at the FAO. But this is just in general true. So we don't think that that rangeland as a whole is producing a tremendous amount of food. So if we can, this is the one thought, if we can protect our forests while simultaneously increasing productivity on our existing range lines, then we have a real potential to make a big growth forward in limiting or stopping deforestation. And at the same time, those productivity increases in grazing land will reduce emissions, because probably many of you know, but not all, methane emissions are a lot higher from poor quality forage than higher quality forage. Now, another issue regarding rangeland. It came to me a couple months ago that rangelands are probably the largest source even of our nitrous oxide and methane emissions. And this is a paper by Eric Davidson in Nature, where he explored the question that was raised by Paul Crookson of how do we account for all the nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. And what he Crookson pointed out that basically our emissions estimates for fertilizer are higher than our emissions estimates, or don't account for all the nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. And Davidson was able to figure out that it could be accounted for if you accounted for the emissions from the nitrous oxide from manure. And I'm going to jump real quickly here, because I think I'm running out of time. But generally speaking, this is an FAO estimate. Nitrous oxide emissions from grazing land are higher than nitrous oxide emissions from intensive oxygen systems. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't have grazing land? No. What it means is we need to improve our productivity of our grazing lands and spare additional grazing lands for reforestation or for effect. Okay. Let me jump. Just make one other point here, and then I'm going to. One other area I want to touch on is nitrous oxide emissions from fertilizer application. Now, this is a paper from Ken Hansen. And we know there are a lot of places in the world that apply excess nitrogen, and we can improve our nitrogen use efficiency. But one of the things we know is that, in general, the developing world is on the part of the curve where if they build their fields to apply more nitrogen, their nitrogen use efficiency is going to go down. Meanwhile, in the developed world, we finally reach the point where it's slightly going up. So I think there's a lot of potential here. So this is an area where we not only need to think of the small and the opportunities to improve nitrogen use efficiency, we also need to think of big technological changes. And one of the more exciting ideas I've heard about is a project by the IPCC in Pakistan, whereby turning urea into these super granules, which can actually be made locally, and planted right with the rice, they've been able to reduce dramatically improve efficiency, improve yield, and reduce nitrogen use. So that's one of the big technological issues we face. Okay. Some final thoughts. Research goes into multiple areas. Take the case of rice, for example. We might be able to make big progress in rice and reducing methane emissions if we can breed rice varieties that need less water. But in the short term, and so that's an area for research, in the short term we have an immediate issue, which is we know that in China, most of the rice farms drain their fields in mid-season and therefore reduce their methane emissions, but the rest of Asia is gone. Why is that? We don't really know. And then on the other hand, we don't really know all the chemistry that goes on in these rice areas. So this is an area of basic study. So as you think about your research, you want to be thinking about the technological investigations that you can promote. You want to be thinking about analyzing the background data and understanding to implement policy. So how do we actually facilitate mid-season drainage to reduce methane emissions outside of China? And you want to be thinking about basic research to understand, so we really get a much better understanding of what it is that's actually going on, so we can do a much better job. And I'm not going to go through all of these because I think I'm running out of time. But in the crop fertilization area, it's the same kind of thing. we really want to be focusing on new forms of fertilizer, but we really don't even know a lot of what determines whether nitrogen in soil becomes available. So that's an area of basic research we need. And then we also know that farmers all over the world are using way too much fertilizer. In Iowa, the Iowa Soybean Association has shown that most farmers in Iowa can use a third less fertilizer and actually improve their economic yields. And they don't do it. They don't have all that information. There clearly are things we can do to demonstrate and prove that what we think, which is that fertilizer application levels can go down in the rest of the world. People probably hand it out. I won't go through all of these, but basically the same kind of issue comes in for all of these other kinds of questions. A little advertisement, which is that I do think that a lot of the challenge we have is not just the basic research, but it's a question of figuring out the policies that we can implement to advance this forward. The Packer Foundation has been funding us in Princeton to try to organize international policy analysis of the same issues you're dealing with. It'd be great to have your support.